Thank you very much, Emilio. It's a pleasure to be here. However, I've had, as I thought about this presentation, a couple of worries. One is that I am going to be presenting, as I so often do, an analysis of a problem without being able to give you a solution, particularly giving you a solution that involves a government program. On the other hand, then I said to myself, everybody in this room is in that same position in the things that you talk about. You don't have any government programs to solve the problems that you talk about either. The other thing that has occurred to me as I have thought about what I'm going to say tonight is, am I sounding like a crabby old geezer? And that may be true. On the other hand, as I look around the room, there are a number of others of you who had that same problem too, and so we'll plunge ahead. The title for this evening's program is The Pursuit of Truth and the Education of the Gifted, and the specific title of my talk is On Holding Feet to the Fire, and that is exactly the nature of my message, which is that's what we've got to do with the educationally gifted. What's the problem with the way we are educating the gifted now? Well, I see three aspects of it. First, the gifted, when they complete their education, are mentally unfinished. Maybe the right word is that they're mentally unpolished. The second problem is that they are ethically illiterate. And the third problem is that they are too often ignorant of the totality of America. Let me take up each of these in turn. And the reason I'm doing it is because all of these deficiencies in the education of the gifted right now are important for all of the rest of us, because these are the kids who will eventually rise to positions where they run the politics, culture, and economy of the country. Mentally unfinished. What do I have in mind by that? Well, it's not that they don't get good professional training. That's not the issue. America's graduate schools and professional schools are considered to be the best in the world. And the fact is that we graduate lawyers who know their law, and physicians who know their medicine, and engineers who know their engineering. In terms of professional training, we do that pretty well. What we do not do in the colleges at the present time is we don't demand precision and rigor at the building block level. So that when students write term papers these days, you don't start with the elements of spell it correctly, correct grammar, and then beyond that, syntactical precision. If you were to go to most college students today and talk to them about logical fallacies in sentence, I'd be curious to know how many of them even know what a fallacy is, let alone be able to give you the catalog of Aristotle's fallacies. And furthermore, what happens, and a lot of you in this room who have taught college students know exactly what I mean, that if you take a sentence and say, as a construction of words, this sentence is simply false, because as a construction of words, it is fallacious, the response you are often going to get, well, yes, but my point is such and such, and the point is obviously true. The idea that something can be false as a construction of words has no meaning for them. And yet the fact is that if you are to think precisely, if you are to evaluate options precisely, you must have precision in your ability to cope with the language. After the book was out, Real Education, and I had said at some point in the book that I wasn't thinking in terms of a college education that required learning classical Greek, I had a very interesting comment made to me by someone who said, you don't understand. The reason you require classical Greek is not so they can learn Greek. It's so they can learn English. Because a good classical Greek course requires you to translate from the Greek into English, and that makes all the difference in understanding your own language. And he persuaded me. There's also a problem with mentally unfinished in terms of the evaluation of data and the formation of judgments. So that too often, when an argument is made, feet are not held to the fire for saying that these data that you have brought to bear on this issue have not been interpreted correctly, they have not been applied correctly, you have not taken into account the variety of factors that are necessary to take a mass of information and deal with it with a sense of all the things that can go wrong. So these are areas of the education of the gifted in which basically what you need is not a government program, but you do need professors who once again are expected to be hypercritical, particularly, most particularly, of those students who are best able to profit from being hypercritical. However, of the three problems, I think that's the least important. The next up the ladder is the problem of what I have called ethical illiteracy. You know, up until the Civil War, the whole purpose of college was to educate students in the meaning of life. Now, a lot of that was done up until the Civil War through Christian theology, which was at the absolute center of most college curricula. But even after the Civil War, as the colleges became less closely tied to religion, it was taken for granted that first there was a core body of knowledge in the humanities that could be taught, and that did inform the fundamental questions of the meaning of life. And they were all expected to do that. That's what a liberal education was supposed to be about. It is also the case that they understood that these are questions that must be thought about if you are to become a fully mature human being. And, best of all, they are the kinds of questions that 19 and 20-year-olds are ready to ask of themselves anyway. As far as I can tell, this is an issue which has been dropped from most college curricula in any systematic way. I have in mind two things. The overarching question is, what does it mean to live a good human life? The two subsidiary questions that feed into that are first a matter of virtue, what constitutes virtuous behavior, and the second is the issue of thinking about the good, with a capital G on good. The problem is, we don't do that. Instead, we teach kids how to be nice, or that they should be nice. We don't tell them that being nice is not being good. When it comes to virtue, I had a college audience a couple of weeks ago, and I said, how many people in the room can name for me Aristotle's four cardinal virtues? Now, I didn't expect a lot of hands to go up, but it was a big audience, and I expected one hand to go up, or two hands, and none did. The four cardinal virtues, I'm not going to ask this audience because I don't want to lose our train of thought at this point. The four cardinal virtues, as most of you I'm sure know, are temperance, courage, practical wisdom, and justice. Those same cardinal virtues are present in all of the major ethical systems that I am familiar with. Which is to say that in today's world, the reaction of colleges when you say that students should be taught about the meaning of virtue is say, oh, well, but which virtue? What kind of virtue? You have to be understanding of all the different ways that different cultures talk about these things. And the point is, no. That almost all the different cultures have very similar understandings of what constitute virtuous behavior. And I don't really care whether my child grows up to be well-versed in Aristotelian virtue or well-versed in Confucian virtue, he will behave in very similar ways no matter which one he learns. The problem is, in college, very few students are ever exposed to a rigorous understanding of what virtue is. And the problem with that is that because being nice is not the same as being good, we have a phenomenon which we have witnessed in the politics of the Congress of the United States time and time again, which is good intentions are all that are important. And what Aristotle called practical wisdom, the ability to foresee the consequences of one's actions or of a course of action, is absolutely critical to making a positive difference in the lives of our fellow human beings. And the failure to appreciate that accounts for all sorts of pernicious and awful well-intended programs that we have suffered through for the last several decades. Next, the issue of thinking about the good. By the good, I mean, what is it in a human life that is the peculiar excellence of being a human being? And how should that affect the way we go about choosing our course of action in life? Here I am more of a multiculturalist. I lived in Thailand for 5 years. I have been fascinated by Asian culture throughout my life, and I am willing to say that while Western civilization has a wonderful corpus of work about the meaning of the good that I value very highly, Asia also has a magnificent corpus of work that takes a somewhat different look at this and has wisdom that we can learn from. The problem is not that students need to learn too many kinds of traditions. The problem is that right now, they don't learn any. And instead, the reigning dogma in college is non-judgmentalism. It is not a case just of being tolerant. It is that you are supposed to be told that you are not to make judgments about different ways of living a human life. Non-judgmentalism, which is the inverse of making precise, rigorous judgments about what life is all about. Let me take up the third of these topics, and now we are getting to the one which I think, you know, as you write a book, and especially as you talk about the book afterwards, at some point you start to realize that this is the thing that's really bothering me. And what I'm about to describe to you is the thing that's really bothering me about the education of the gifted. And that is that they are growing up ignorant of what America is all about in a visceral, fundamental way. It goes back to a problem that is nobody's fault. It is the result of parents trying to make the right decisions for how their family should live their lives, but it is nonetheless a problem for that. Think of it this way. 100 years ago, just about all of America's elites were the children of farmers and shopkeepers and blue-collar workers. We know that to be true because you take a look at the population and that's where the people came from. The people who were college-educated, who were elites in the cities, they were a minuscule number of people. So the people who grew up to control the politics of the country and the economics of the country and the culture of the country, they may have ended up by moving to the Upper East Side of Manhattan or to Beverly Hills or to some other enclave, but they remembered their lives as they grew up. They had a context within which to think about things. Within the last few decades, that has changed dramatically. And it's changed dramatically because of a paradox, but a predictable paradox, that Dick Hernstein and I talked about in The Bell Curve. The more meritocratic a society becomes, the more open the society becomes to rewarding talent, no matter where it comes from, the more stratified it becomes in the long run. And the reason for that is this. You start out by opening up opportunity. Lots more kids going to college in mid-century. All at once, you have this infusion of talent, and you have a lot of churning. You have all sorts of people that are moving rapidly upward socioeconomically. Here's the thing, though. If you are in an age when the man who will become a successful business executive marries at the age of 21 and comes from a small town, who does he marry? He marries the girl next door. And that girl next door may be a really nice girl. She may be even pretty smart, but she's not selected for having a great deal of talent. Now you shift to a world in which all sorts of people who have talent, in fact, just about everybody who has academic talent, goes on to university, and add to that that they don't get married until a mean age of about 30 years old, which is the case now with people with advanced educations. Who do they marry? The rising young business executive marries a rising young business executive. The rising young attorney marries a rising young attorney. The rising young computer programmer in Silicon Valley marries a rising young computer programmer in Silicon Valley. What happens is that you have what the sociologists call assertive mating. Or in plainer terms, you have the talent marrying each other. And I hate to break the news to you, but a lot of IQ is heritable, and so you have really talented kids. You also have kids, by the way, who, well, one of the higher incidences of autism in the country is in Silicon Valley. And what's happened is you have people who have extremely high visual spatial skills and not necessarily very high verbal skills marrying each other, so they get a double whammy and the kids have a higher than average rate of autism. So it's not all good. But the fact is that you have an enormous difference in the degree to which you have successful people in the society not just bequeathing their money to their children, but bequeathing their talent. And so you reach a situation now where it drives the admissions officers in universities nuts because they have all of these applications from brilliant young kids, knock the top off the SATs, they are the debate champions in the state, they have every kind of qualification to get into Harvard, Yale, Stanford, and so forth, and they are overwhelmingly from the upper middle class. And of course, the glib explanation of that is, oh, they sent their kids to SAT coaching courses. Oh, they sent them to all the best schools. And so you have this artificial situation in which it looks like the talent is concentrated in the upper middle class. It's a lot worse than that. The talent really is increasingly concentrated in the upper middle class. And why is that bad? Well, think about their lives. Earlier I said that most of the people who rose to elite positions in this country had been the children of farmers and shopkeepers and blue-collar workers. Today's young people who are going to be the elite of tomorrow, and to a large extent the people who are the elite of today, have lived all their lives in the bubble. They have been born into upper-middle-class comfort. They have gone to schools in which they have met the entire gamut of people from A to B, which is to say they have met people exactly like them in terms of their socioeconomic background and IQ. The school might be racially diverse. It's not socioeconomically diverse in an awful lot of the schools that our kids go to. Here's an example. In the public schools, not the private schools, but the public schools of affluent suburbs in this country, the mean IQ is often between 115 and 120, which means the mean IQ for that school is at about the 85th, 86th percentile of the mean IQ for the country. What does that mean? It means that if your child has gone to that school where there are the smart kids and there are the dummies have IQs that are about the national average. And they have no personal experience whatsoever with an entire half of the distribution of the country. So then they finish high school, and they go off to college. And either they go to select colleges, where once again they meet the range of people from A to B, or they go to a large public university, but the self-selection factors involving the sorority or fraternity they join and the courses they take and the rest of it mean that once again they are in contact with people extremely like themselves. Then they go to graduate school, and it just gets worse and worse. During all this time, I'm not talking about all young people, obviously. I'm talking about an awful lot of them. During all this time, the kids from these upper middle class families, during summer vacation, have not been getting jobs in construction crews. They haven't been working the counter at the Woolworth store. They've been getting internships at places like AEI and Heritage and the Washington Post and the rest of it, where once again, they don't know anybody not like them. They go on to graduate school, straight out of undergraduate school often, and then they get entry-level jobs. And if you're a journalist, you don't get the entry-level job at a small town in Indiana newspaper. You get your entry-level job at a prestigious newspaper someplace. If you're going into business, you get your entry-level job at a nice corporation. So if I could, you're getting the picture, right? It is not a picture that I am making up. It is one that is an affliction for large numbers of our most talented young people. And the problem with all of this is they haven't the slightest idea how the world works. They haven't the slightest idea how America works. Worse than that, they have not, in the course of this upbringing, been exposed to the kinds of things that make America exceptional. When we talk about American exceptionalism, which really gets down to individualism and opportunity and freedom and the themes that people in this room hold dear, they have not in their own lives seen why those things are so wonderful. The guy with a bumper sticker on his car which says, "You can have my gun when you pry it out of my cold, dead hands," understands American exceptionalism. The small businessman, we're talking about mom and pop store maybe here, who saved his money and opened a business and created something out of that which enables him to provide a comfortable living for his family. He deeply loves what makes America exceptional. The kid who has lived the life I have just described may read Milton Friedman, he may read Hayek. To what extent, even if he's one of the tiny minority who become fans, to what extent do they know in their gut what these guys are talking about? Okay, what do we do since we cannot set up a government program to solve it? A lot of it has to do with parents. A lot of it has to do with jawboning. Because I will say something real quickly. As I've talked about some of these themes, the reaction I've generally gotten is to a surprising degree, damn right. I think that these are things that once talked about, an awful lot of parents realize they've been worried about their own kids in this regard. So I don't think that we're fighting against a headwind in trying to say some of these things. What can you do? One thing you can do is move. Even if you have the money to live in McLean or the Upper East Side of New York or Beverly Hills, you don't necessarily have to do that. I'm not saying that you move to a completely alien environment, but look for an environment where there's a broader mix of people. A small town, for example, than in a lot of the affluent suburbs. You can tell your kids that they have to get jobs. They have to make money. They can't go and be an intern at AEI and call that a job because it's not a job. They've got to participate both in paying for their own educations, and they've got to go out and learn what it's like to perform a job satisfactorily. We can tell our kids, don't go straight to college, particularly if you don't really have much of an idea of what you're interested in. Take some time off. Not time off where you live off mom and dad in the basement, no, or in your room, no. You got to go out and you got to support yourself. Go into the military. Do something where you give yourself time to grow up so when you go back to school or when you go to college, you know why you're there. We can encourage them not to go directly from undergraduate school to graduate school. We can also, from the time they're very young, just let it be known as a matter of course that mom and dad will pay for the bulk of the tuition of undergraduate school, though kids are expected to contribute, but they aren't going to pay for graduate school. That when you go to graduate school, that's because you are committed to a vocation. And if you're committed to a vocation, you can damn well figure out a way to get scholarships and money and the rest of it to pay for it. That's going to be your job. As a bit of full disclosure, I am not giving this advice as theoretical advice. I have just gone through what has been told to the Murray kids for years. One of my daughters said, Dad's idea of the ideal summer job is to work at McDonald's by day and clean toilets by night. So that has been sort of the message. And one of them was immensely proud when she spent a couple of weeks working on a cleaning crew at her college where she did, in fact, clean toilets. She has never let me forget that. We moved from a chic neighborhood in downtown Washington 20 years ago next week, as a matter of fact, to Burkittsville, Maryland. Which another daughter of mine describes as being 200 people if you round up. It's a small town, and they went to public high schools in a local blue-collar farming community where they met all these people. Now, mind you, this stuff can backfire. My son, upon completing his high school, said to me, "Dad, you brought us out here so we could get to know all kinds of people, and all you've done is make me into an elitist snob." I have hopes that he will reevaluate his childhood experience as time goes on, but that is a way that these things can backfire. And also, our advice that we gave children that they should buy a one-way air ticket to an interesting country after they graduate and take $1,000 with them and then survive, it worked so well that my wife has now insisted we have a new rule which says that one of the four children must be in the Western Hemisphere at all times. Because right now, none of them are. So I'm like all parents. I've given certain kinds of advice with certain kinds of mixed results. But the kind of thing that I'm saying, I think, are kinds of things that parents ought to start thinking about as possibilities for their own children. And one final thing, and I will close on this one. Something else that the schools can do is to make sure that every gifted child at some point in their educational career are intellectually humiliated. And I say that not because I'm a sadist. The clapping is coming from some very young members of the audience. That's very interesting. That's very interesting. Those are... Those who go into the sciences and mathematics, I accept from what I'm about to say, or engineering for that matter. If you go into any of those fields in college, you are very likely to be intellectually humiliated as a matter of course. Because the fact is, if you take math long enough, everybody runs into a wall where they hear themselves saying, "I think I understand," to the professor, at which point you know you've hit the wall. But you can go into the social sciences or the humanities, and let's face it, that's where an awful lot of people who run the country go into. You can go into that from kindergarten through PhD and never take a course in which you have to say to yourself, "I can't do this." And as a result of that, you get done with all of that and you really don't know in your gut that there are some things you just aren't smart enough to figure out. And it's really important to know that. One of the reasons it's important to know that is for empathy. Talented young people go through grade school and they watch the slower kids in the class hit the wall and be humiliated by that. They, in junior high school and high school, see other kids who can't keep up and drop by the wayside in intellectual pursuits. Well, it's really important they know there is a point at which they, too, are going to have exactly that same experience. That's one reason. Another reason was encapsulated by George Christian, who was one of LBJ's press secretaries. And he said something once which has stuck with me ever since. He said, "No one should be allowed to work in the West Wing of the White House who has not suffered a major disappointment in life." And the reason he said that was it was essential that people in that building know how badly things can go wrong. I think that was a profoundly true statement. It is profoundly disturbing to me that we do have someone in the White House who has never suffered a major disappointment in his adult life, and he occupies the really good office in the West Wing. It is a difficulty if you are in a position of power and you have never had these kinds of experiences. So what I am saying is that as we educate the gifted, we don't need to try to make them smarter, we need to try to make them wiser. And we also need to teach them that they too are Americans. Not teach them that in a book, but teach them that in ways which correspond, which are incorporated into their life experience. They've got to learn that wonderful feeling of having succeeded against the odds, which is so central to the satisfactions of American exceptionalism. They've got to understand in their gut the ways in which America created a way for people of all kinds to live together, which is unique among the nations of the earth and immeasurably precious. Thank you very much.